Don't panic. Our European friends can raise NATO's game.
Over the last few weeks, a series of speeches have described the Russian threat to peace in Europe. On the 10th of January, Sweden's civil defense minister Carl-Oskar Bohlin asserted that there could be war in Sweden. This warning was reinforced by the Swedish military commander-in-chief, Gen. Mikhail Biden, suggested that Swedes should mentally prepare for this to happen. On the 15th of January, the UK's defense secretary, Grant Shapps, told the assembled audience at Lancaster House that a pre-war inflection point had been reached one just 2 days after that. The Dutch chair of NATO's military committee, Admiral Robert Baur, warned that the era of predictability was over and that NATO needed a war-fighting transformation, as an all-out war with Russia could happen at any stage in the next 20 years. For what, you may ask, is going on? The procession of dire warnings have led commentators to ponder whether the UK's fighting-age population are ready, willing, and mentally prepared for what they may be required to do. This is nothing new. In the early 1900s, the ruling upper strata of post-Edwardian society worried that the social and psychological character of the urban working class had made them unfit to fight a major war. Five, of course, the vast majority of the working classes did not flinch in responding to the call to arms during the First World War. Indeed, it was the middle and upper class students at Oxford University who, in 1933, debated and passed, by 275 votes to 153, a motion proposed by Cyril Edwin Mitchinson Jode that this House will under no circumstances fight for king and country. Whether or not the majority of the current population feels that modern Britain represents their cultural aspirations and is therefore worth fighting for is, perhaps, a more prescient concern. 6. Regarding the scale of the Russia threat, a study, in 2018, compared the size of its economy with that of the American state of Texas. Texas's economy, with its rapidly growing population, was adjudged the larger. It was noted that Russia's population was shrinking due to low birth rates. 7. That said, the dictum that you need a strong economy to have strong national defense forces does not seem to apply to hybrid totalitarian states. 8. Nevertheless, there comes a point at which war casualties and economic fragility coalesce. A U.S. intelligence assessment reported that by December 2023, as many as 315,000 Russian soldiers had been killed or injured in the war in Ukraine, and that the losses in that war had set back Russia's military modernization by 18 years. If correct, should we be that concerned about the likelihood that Russia will attack a recently enlarged NATO in Western Europe in the next decade? 9. What do Biden, Baur, and Pistorius know and provides the logic of Lanchester's square law? Perhaps the Americans have told their European friends that when the situation in Ukraine is resolved, they will concentrate on Asia and expect the Europeans to defend themselves against a militarily reinvigorated but economically fragile Russia. NATO's defense is predicated on the assumption that each country will spend at least 2% of its gross domestic product, GDP, on defense. After America decided to pivot to Asia, President Barack Obama's administration hoped that its European NATO allies would embrace the idea of smart defense, where national capabilities and resources were pooled and shared to optimize their effectiveness. This concept appears to have been designed to make up for the absence of some American capabilities in Europe, and the Mediterranean 10 Europe's ability to satisfy this desire rested on the character of their leaders and their willingness to spend their fair share of their country's GDP on defense. Unfortunately, Obama had a tendency to assess the leaders of Europe's largest economic and military states by the depth of their experience and their progressive credentials rather than by their commitment to European security and defense. He thought Angela Merkel was steady, honest, intellectually rigorous, and instinctively kind, a savvy politician who knew her constituency. David Cameron, the United Kingdom's UK Prime Minister, was adjudged to have an impressive command of the issues for a man who'd never been pressed too hard by life. The French President, Nicolas Sarkozy, was so disorganized that he was unlikely to come up with a clear plan for his own country, much less for all of Europe. 11. Obama may have admired Merkel, but she didn't take defense seriously, as her focus was on the economy, and she empathized with her population's ambivalence towards its own military. This despite the recommendations of several European think tanks which advised that more needed to be done. 12 at the time, the UK Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, hoped to build the UK's future on similarly solid economic foundations. 13 in 2015, after Sheriff's remarks, the broadcaster Andrew Marr attempted to goad Osborne into saying that he would ring-fence defence spending. Osborne told him, "You cannot have strong national defence without a strong national economy." The two go hand in hand. 14 that year, Germany's gross domestic product, GDP, of $3.358 trillion was 14% higher than the United Kingdom's UK, $2.935 trillion total. Nevertheless, predictably, the forward-leaning UK, which adjudged itself to be one of the more capable European military powers, was content to take the lead as a framework nation for operations in and around Europe. 15. Smart defence could only work if European nations spent what they were expected to spend on defence, but reliance on NATO's principle of collective defence conditioned them to expect open-ended American support. It spawned an attitude of complacency, which, together with the desire to be re-elected, resulted in defence spending attracting a relatively lower priority. It was events in Libya in 2011 that exposed the scale of the fault lines. Although the political will existed to prevent the expected massacre of civilians in Benghazi, it fell to French and UK forces to act quickly. 16. It was evident that many European nations, France, and the UK included, did not possess all of the capabilities necessary to play a worthwhile part in the intervention. Obama found the willingness of the French and British to commit to military activity that they were independently incapable of undertaking very irritating. 17. He refused to take Cameron's telephone calls for a while, and when he reluctantly agreed to provide the resources requested, he attached conditions. 19. A year later, Philip Hammond, the UK Defence Secretary, acknowledged that Libya had cruelly exposed the imbalances and weaknesses in NATO, and thus the scale of the task facing European NATO nations. He made clear that he wanted European defence expenditure to increase markedly, and that Libya had exposed the countries that could but wouldn't, and those who would but couldn't. 20 diplomatic attempts to chide the other European powers into spending more on defence failed dismally. Obama's successor, Donald Trump, decided to tackle the issue head-on, but his blunt, brutish and weird negotiating tactics were widely misinterpreted as an assault on NATO itself. As far as most of the media was concerned, Merkel was the adult and Trump a badly behaved and ill-informed child. 21. The photograph, released by Merkel's spokesman after the June 2018 G7 summit, epitomized attempts to depict her intellectual superiority over the undiplomatic, rude, recalcitrant, and naive American president. It is unclear whether a behind-the-doors agreement had been brokered for the Europeans to increase their defence spending to 2.0% by 2025, but if it had, Trump sensed that the agreement would be quietly ignored. So, in July 2018, at the NATO summit in Brussels, he demanded that the Europeans spend what they ought to spend as soon as practically possible. Haranguing Merkel in public, he accused her of being totally controlled by Russia because of her decision to expand German reliance on Russian gas. What good is NATO if Germany is paying Russia billions of dollars for gas and energy? The US is paying for Europe's protection, then loses billions on trade. Must pay 2% of GDP. IMMEDIATELY, not by 2025. One NATO leader described this outburst as a bizarre spectacle. A Guardian journalist reported that what Trump had done would please Vladimir Putin, who has long pursued a strategy of creating division in NATO. 22. Yet Trump's underlying message echoed what Hammond had said. Both men wanted NATO's defense to be properly funded. Hammond's diplomatic approach had been ineffective, but Trump's caused outrage. Merkel was universally admired by the international press corps and lauded as a strong and intelligent woman. As the table below makes clear, she had no intention of raising defense spending as a proportion of GDP. She would ignore Trump in much the same way as she had ignored Obama and Hammond on the topic of defense spending. 23. Events have a habit of making fools of those who think they are well equipped to differentiate between the righteous and the wicked. 24. Merkel left office 2 months before Russia invaded Ukraine and European reliance on Russian gas became overtly apparent. Sanders has consistently worried about the decline in the size of the British Army. Nonetheless, his claim that Britain, why not NATO, cannot rely on its naval and air power but must instead have an army of at least 120,000 soldiers to fight and win wars. His intervention, I believe, should be seen as part of the enduring internecine fight for resources. 25 Meanwhile, Edward Stringer, a retired air marshal, argued that Britain, not NATO, needs to react to Houthi attacks in the Red Sea by dealing with their puppet master Iran. If, as reported elsewhere, a $1 billion weapon deal was signed between Russia and Iran to produce 6,000 of a Geron II variant of the Shahed 136 attack drone, the links between the Russians, the Iranians, and the Houthis are clear for all to see. 26. Stringer's policy recommendations followed the usual script adopted by retired senior officers, recommending that the UK's military capabilities be bolstered. 27. One thing Sanders and Stringer agree on is that drones will play a major role in future wars. Indeed, Sanders thought that the gaps in the UK's inventory of drones, artillery, and ammunition should be filled sooner rather than later. Given the way drone warfare has evolved, he could have mentioned the need to prioritise equipment to protect our forces from drone attacks so they have the freedom to operate without incurring morally dispiriting losses. Another 40,000 troops is unlikely to be the answer to this conundrum. Surely, given drones are relatively cheap to produce, our defence against them must also be affordable. Expensively exotic missiles to destroy cheap drones are surely not the best way forward in the long term. In this context, directed energy weapons, such as those exhibited by the Project Dragonfire team, offer a potentially affordable solution in terms of cost per shot. Before the UK considers spending any more of its GDP on defence, it is worthwhile looking again at what our European NATO counterparts spend on their defence. The figures from 2022 suggest that many of them are unlikely to spend the required 2.0% of GDP anytime soon. Is it reasonable for the European Union members of NATO, whose leaders were uncompromising and sometimes patronising when dealing with their UK counterparts during the Brexit negotiations, to expect the UK to spend proportionately more blood and money to fill the smart defence gaps they have allowed to develop? 28. Admittedly, the table below only shows the percentage of GDP spent on defence, not the actual amount of money provided. Nevertheless, it suggests that, apart from the UK, the countries nearest Russia take their defence more seriously than those that are further away. It may well be politically difficult for a German government to spend more on defence, as their economy in 2023 was the worst performing major economy in the world. 29. If war is really imminent, this should not give Germany an excuse for missing 2.0% target. The sheer size of the German economy means that if 2.0% of its GDP were spent on defence, it would, gradually, become Europe's military powerhouse. At the time of writing, only America and the UK are involved militarily in the Red Sea in response to Houthi attacks on international shipping. Is it right that the UK should be the only European NATO nation taking part in action that aims to benefit all European nations? Is this another case of countries that could but wouldn't, and those who would but couldn't? So, before we rush to do satisfy what Sanders's and Stringer's want us to do, we should perhaps ask if the recent statements made by Biden, Bauer, and Pistorius were really designed to remind Europe's political leaders to satisfy NATO spending targets. Ultimately, the UK should exert whatever pressure it can on our European allies to get them to spend more on defence. If they did so in the spirit of smart defence, it would go a long way to dissuade Putin from attempting to bring the Baltic states back under Russian control after the war in Ukraine ends. Privately, we could let the Europeans know that, until they spend their fair share on Europe's defence, our willingness to fill the gaps they have allowed to open might be conditional on some sort of economic quid pro quo. The tone of the Brexit negotiations should embolden our politicians to do this. Hammond-style diplomacy failed. In October 2023, Christian Lindner, the German finance minister, suggested new steps were needed in Britain's post-Brexit trade relations with the EU. 30. Apparently, Germany's latest Heckler and Koch G95A1 assault rifle does not shoot straight when using military standard ammunition. 31. Perhaps we should also remind Pistorius that we have a defence industry ready and willing to accommodate the large defense orders Germany should be making. That would be a good start,